We're again tonight looking at Jacob under the theme, Developing Depth in Ourselves. And tonight's passage of Scripture will span from Genesis, the 29th chapter, verse 14, through Genesis chapter 33, verse 4, although we will not, of course, read extensively from these sections, but that will be the parameters of our scriptural examination this evening. If I were subtitling this message, I would simply call it The Struggle, for the message is really for anyone who is in struggle. Now, I do believe that all of us, in one way or another, are involved in struggle. Some of us are more painfully aware of the struggle of life that we are engaged in. Some wrestle with the dark side of their personality and really wonder at this moment in your life which is going to get the upper hand, the Christ-like side or the dark side. And others struggle with whether or not they're going to get accomplished what they were intended for. How is it all going to come out? How is the struggle that I am facing now in my life going to happen? What's going to be the result? There are perilous passages in our life where our fate truly does hang in the balance. And in those moments, we are literally in suspension, and there is simply nothing we can do. Like Jacob, we must find God doing some things for us if things are going to turn out all right. If after having done everything I can, I succeed, it will not be because of me. It will be because of God. That is an underlying message of Jacob through and through, that in the struggle, when the bottom line is written, the only thing that accounts for his success is that God was with him. Since I am the kind of person who always likes to have at least 3 points or more, I have reduced the struggle in these chapters to three major assumptions, three major truths in my own struggle and in your struggle. God, if I'm to succeed, God has to overrule my sins and my mistakes, my personal liabilities and my limitations. And if he doesn't overrule those things, I will never accomplish the purpose for which I have been sent. Now, when I use the term God has to overrule my sins and my mistakes, I don't use the word has in a sense of moral necessity. God doesn't have to do anything. But it's conditional. If I am to win in my struggle of life, God must, has to, overrule my sins, my weaknesses, and my earthly limitations. Prime example of this is Jacob. He starts out, we know, and we've already looked at this in preceding weeks, as the deceiver. God had to overrule that element of his nature. But when you look at his marital situation, you see compounded problems. And the ability of Jacob to emerge successfully from what he stepped into can only be accounted and attributed to the fact that God went with him and redid some of the terrible, tragic mistakes that he made. Actually, he finds out when he gets married that Laban is capable of deceiving him just as well as he was capable of deceiving Esau. And classic understated humor, as well as ironic, poetic justice, is found in the fact that Laban, in the nighttime, gives to Jacob his eldest Leah. And verse 25 of Genesis 29 says, "Lo, when morning came, there was Leah." Jacob then turns, because he is still in love with Rachel, agrees to serve another 7 years for Rachel. So after his wedding week with Leah, he marries Rachel. In time, Leah begins to bear him children. Rachel becomes jealous. She is childless. She gives him her handmaiden Bilhah. Jacob has 2 sons by Bilhah. Leah becomes jealous, gives Jacob her handmaiden Zilpah. Zilpah bears 2 sons. And then one day, Reuben, Leah's oldest son, is coming in from the fields with mandrakes, a supposed aphrodisiac. Rachel sees him. Leah trades the mandrakes for the privilege of sleeping with Jacob that night. And God, without with Rachel having the aphrodisiacs, is still unproductive, and Leah gives birth to another son, and then another son, and then finally, at the last, Rachel gives birth to two sons. Complicated, isn't it? Sinful, isn't it? And we don't find anywhere along the line Jacob making much protest to all that's going on. When you look at these women, you see that at least three out of the four had absolutely no control over their own lives. Leah had no control. She was at the disposal of her father. Bilhah was at the disposal of her mistress, Rachel. Zilpah was at the disposal of her mistress, Leah. They do not have freedom in the sense that we have freedom. And I think even a question can be raised as to whether or not Rachel had freedom. But Jacob, I suppose it would be easy living from our context to judge him. But we must remember he did not have the law of Moses, nor did he have the gospel of Jesus Christ. From his own grandfather Abraham, the godly Abraham, he had the example of a concubine. And so living in the light of his times, he must be judged in the light of the revelation that he had. For Leah, one cannot help but feel tremendous pity. The scriptures define her as a person who had weak eyes, that is, she was nearsighted, and she was not lovely in form and beautiful as Rachel, Genesis 29:17, her younger sister. Now that has to hurt. When people are comparing you to your younger sister and saying, she could be Miss Israel, what a knockout she is, but boy, you sure got left out when God was handing out looks. And it has to hurt that after their brief honeymoon, Leah knew that Jacob still wanted Rachel. And Leah tries hard to gain Jacob's love. When her first son is born, she calls him Reuben. She says, and she names him because his name means, he, that is God, has seen my misery. And she says, when this child is born, surely my husband will love me now. But he doesn't. He still loves Rachel. So a second time she gives birth, this time to Simeon, and she calls this child the name which means one who hears. And she says, because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he has given me this one too. And the third time she has a son, and she calls his name attached, that is Levi. And she says, now at last my husband will be attached to me. Naming the children in a pathetic hope that if she could just be productive enough, her husband would love her. When the fourth son, Judah, is born, she calls him Praise. And perhaps that's the maturest name she gave any of her six sons, because that name means simply, this time I will praise the Lord. And nothing is said about that son being an attempt to win her husband's favor. After years of not bearing children, she gives birth to Issachar, the fifth child, and she's still trying to win her husband's approval. Issachar's name means reward, and she says, God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. And finally, her last son, Zebulun, she calls honor, because she says, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will honor me because I have borne him six sons. Tragic. Jacob never really did return the love to Leah that she so desperately sought and tried in every way to win. And yet, God takes these six sons of Leah, the two sons of Bilhah, the two sons of Zilpah, and the two sons of Rachel, and melds them into the nation Israel, the chosen people. And God works through Jacob's failures, through Leah's inability to accept herself, to accept, and for Jacob's inability to ever love Leah. God works nevertheless through all of this and brings it ultimately in the end for good. Just because God brings it about for good does not mean that it was right. God worked Calvary for the good, but Calvary was not right. The people that nailed Jesus to the cross were not doing the right thing, but God worked it for the right and for the good. And the same way with Jacob's family and with his tortured relationships. I'm sure that Leah lived and died feeling like a failure. even after Rachel died, we never read of Jacob turning to her after Rachel's death. When the time comes for Jacob to go down to Egypt, all his wives have dropped from mention, perhaps suggesting by that time they have died. After Rachel's death, Leah is never mentioned again, and we read of no tomb marker being built for her, such as we have read that Jacob built for Rachel. I'm sure that she died feeling she had been a failure, but she wasn't. She was honored by being the mother of the priestly tribe, the tribe of Levi, and she was honored by being the mother of the kingly messianic line, the line of Judah, from which comes Christ. We are not, in the last analysis, in the best position to judge our contribution. Only God can judge our worth. And only God can take what appears to be a lifelong struggle for acceptance and for worth. Only God can take a deathbed defeat, which Leah surely felt, and in his economy and justice, see that it turns out for the good and for positive. With all of Jacob's struggle, and with the struggle that he then forced upon his family, God nevertheless brings it around and ultimately brings it for good in the establishment of a nation. I think of the song which describes the grace of God toward us. Marvelous grace of our loving Lord, grace that exceeds our sin and our guilt. Yonder on Calvary's mount outpoured, there where the blood of the Lamb was spilt. Sin and despair, like the sea waves cold, threaten the soul with infinite loss. Grace that is greater, yes, grace untold, points to the refuge, the mighty cross. Dark is the stain that we cannot hide. What can avail to wash it away? Look, there is flowing a crimson tide, whiter than snow you may be today. I'm sure that there are people within our audience this evening who feel that their sins, their mistakes, their personal limitations, and their failures have won in their own struggle for life. But that is not the way it is going to end. God has to overrule those, and in Jacob's case, we will see that he does. A second factor in the struggle is that not only must God overrule my sins and my mistakes, my limitations and my failures, if I am to succeed, but God has to be present to me in my turning moments in life. The moments in life when I truly am in jeopardy and when I hang in the balance. Jacob will come to drink deeply of the medicine of his own duplicity. Laban will cheat him time and time again. But unlike Esau, Jacob will display traits of personality not found in a loser like Esau. Jacob has tenacity, and he sticks by the goods. In Genesis chapter 30, verse 26, we find that Jacob wants to leave Laban, but Laban does not want him to. So they strike a deal that Jacob could have all the many-colored or streaked goats and the black sheep, the sheep and the goats that were not as numerous. Now, over the years, Laban would change the terms so that the color of the sheep and the goats would sometimes vary. But it's a very fascinating thing to see Jacob trying to accomplish a crude genetical experiment at the end of Genesis chapter 30 after he'd cut the deal with Laban. He knows that he's going to get the streaked or the many-colored goats and the black sheep, so he takes those animals and he, in their watering troughs, takes strips of bark and he peels them so that they appear to be streaked. And he has the goats and the sheep mate before them, no doubt under the conception that if the goats and the sheep see the bark that is speckled, they will associate the idea and it will have an impact upon conception. A very crude idea of genetical engineering, which we know doesn't have a chance of working. The smarter thing, however, that Jacob did is found in verses 41 and 42, where he put the stronger animals in the front and let them mate, and they become his progeny. He was displaying some selective breeding. But in the last analysis, all this is a whole lot of hokey, because Jacob finally admits in chapter 31 that, verse 9, God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them unto me. And he says in verse 5, the God of my father has been with me. Now that's very intriguing. I'm sure if you asked Jacob, in the one side of him, the human side of him. Jacob, why was it that you prospered in your flocks with Laban? He would say, well, because I used this experiment. I was smart enough to put the poles in the water, and the sheep associated the idea of the stripped bark with speckled goats and dark sheep, and they bred that way. But we all know that couldn't have been the case. What happened? God was with him. And in his more honest moments, he admits that that indeed was the case. It would not be the last time God's part in a success would be much greater than seen to the observer. We have a tendency to give ourselves more credit for our successes than we deserve. If any of us succeed at anything, it is because God enables us to do it. God summons Jacob away from Laban and back to the land of Abraham, back to the land of Esau. He must go back, because if we run from difficulty, our character will never be fully established till we face it. And as he heads into that turning moment with Esau, he must return of necessity, just as Jesus forced the disciples to undergo more than one storm at sea. Because they had failed in the first storm, he will make them face the second storm. And because Peter failed in one denial, Jesus will force him to face the threefold question of, do you love me? And the Lord inevitably never lets us run away, but keeps us coming back until we face up to our nemesis, that which we struggle with in life. God has to be present in the turning moments. And for Jacob, those years of serving Laban, where he had come to him without anything and leaving with flocks and with children, can only be attributed to the fact that God prospered him. The third thing about the struggle is that if we are to succeed ultimately, God must resolve our identity as a person. And this brings up the struggle that Jacob has on the eve of facing Esau when he wrestles with the angel of the Lord. The Christian psychologist John Stanford says the following about Laban's struggle with his identity and his coming back to the land from which he had fled. God's command to him, go back to your land, is ominous. For we must remember that this meant returning to the land of Esau and facing the prospect of revenge at the hands of his estranged brother. It was not a happy prospect which Jacob faced. To be sure, he had to leave Haran, but why return to the land of Esau? Why not go another direction and find a safe home? Jacob, however, decides to obey the divine voice. His deepest instinct is that he must trust God's command, no matter how great the dangers seem to be, and God is faithful to this instinct, even though he is not in a position to know what God has in mind. However, we are in a position to see why Jacob needed to return to the land of his origins. The whole of Jacob's life since he left his home has been a long process of coming to terms with himself and the replacement of his egocentricity with a larger God-given personality. But this developmental process cannot be completed until Jacob returns to the land of his earlier misdeeds and confronts Esau. To be sure, Jacob has done well in the land of Laban, living an honest and valuable life, but he has not yet faced up to the person he had been as a youth. Nor has he made amends for the terrible things he did to his brother. His spiritual development cannot be complete until he is reconciled with Esau and has faced and taken responsibility for the deceitful person he has been in the past. We must, in the last analysis, come to grips with the darker side of ourself if we are to succeed. And God does this with Jacob. He forces him finally to affirm a new identity as a person and come to grips with his old identity as the deceiver. The way you will find that God selects is not an escapist route. It is so easy to think when we are in conflict and in struggle with the psalmist, oh, that I had the wings of a dove and could fly away to the furthest stretches of the sea. Oh, that I had wings of morning and could escape. But if we are to be made as people, we are going to have to be made by facing our realities and by working through them. As Jacob begins to return to his land, God gives him encouragement. Chapter 32, verse 1, where angels meet him as he is on the way, and he calls the place Mahanaim, which means two camps. One encampment was the encampment of Jacob, and the other encampment, that of the angels. Then Jacob sends scouts who return with news that frightens him. He has sent them to tell Esau that he is on the way, but they return saying that Esau has 400 men and is coming toward him. There follows then in Genesis 32 a description of Jacob, the man of prayer and the man of planning. He begins to pray, and his prayer in verse 9 is earnest as he faces into the hurricane. O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac. First time he had ever addressed God in those terms. The God who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. The prayer shows that over his life, Jacob has come through to tremendous maturity in his praying. But praying is never enough for Jacob. He must also do something. And like us, he prays and he plans, and I guess that's okay. He takes 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys to send before him to give as a present to Esau. Not bad, eh? That would be equivalent in our day to sending about 5 silver cloud Rolls Royces, 10 Eldorado Cadillacs, and you can fill in the rest. But there comes a moment when Jacob must finally be still. On the edge of meeting Esau the next day, he will come within himself and be alone. And there comes a strange moment when a man becomes present to him and wrestles with him until daybreak. When you look at Jacob's life, all of his life had been wrestling and struggle. He had struggled with Isaac. He had struggled with Esau. He had struggled with Laban. And he had struggled within himself. As he stands on the edge of meeting his brother, he is 90 years, calendar years of age. He had been 70 years of age when he had stolen the blessing and had left home. Now at 90. And when I think of Jacob and know that he lived past 130 years, I put his psychological lifespan into a 70-year period to understand it a little bit better, because I can't think in terms of 130 years. And I would suspect that in those days when they lived in those ages, that perhaps that you could understand their years better by squeezing them into our psychological lifespan. This would have meant that he would have, in our psychological lifespan, have left home at 38 and 10 years later returned to meet God at the age of 48. It is now make or break time, and the struggle occurs in the evening, in the dead of night, as most struggles do. If you are in struggle with a problem, if you are in struggle with a relationship, if you are in struggle with God, the great likelihood is that the deeper the darkness of the night is, the deeper your struggle will be. And 3 to 4 to 5 in the morning is when it usually really comes to a head. How many know what I'm talking about? You don't. Yeah, a lot of you do. I wasn't necessarily seeking a raising of hands. But any of you that have carried heavy burdens know that the intensity of those burdens comes in the dark hours when you rise and you cannot sleep. With Jacob, a man becomes present. The man we know to be God. He is described in the book of Hosea as the angel of the Lord, a description which is used in the Old Testament to describe whenever God became present in the Old Testament in human form. Jacob himself realizes later that he has struggled with God, for he says, as he calls the place Peniel in verse 30 of chapter 32, I saw God, he says, face to face. And the angel himself says to him in verse 28 of chapter 32, you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. This struggle is showing Jacob and showing us that our ultimate struggle is with God Himself. That if we are struggling, for example, in a relationship, we must look past the particular struggle of that relationship and see that how we emerge from that relationship will of itself determine our standing with God and that it is God who struggles with us, that we might emerge in that difficulty as a different and a renewed person, and rather being defeated by the trauma of that relationship, rather than it being simply a contest with another person, it will become something greater than that. It will have a cosmic, theological nature to it, where we envision that conflict as a really, of essence, a struggle with God, for it is never a conflict with another person. It is ultimately a spiritual matter of our conflict, whether God is going to implant His disposition and nature upon our hearts, and we're going to emerge from that with the touch of God upon our lives, and we may limp thereafter, as did Jacob. We might have some identifying sign that will mark our life that we have been in a struggle with God. But show me a person who has been through a struggle of any kind, and who in the midst of that struggle has made the leap and the association that here I am not wrestling with just flesh and blood. Here I'm not just wrestling with a relationship. Here I'm not just wrestling with financial disaster. Here I am wrestling with God for my eternal destiny. And how I will emerge from this will determine me from here on out. I must find my identity. I must find who I am in this moment. It is when we come to that place in our life that we become in a position where God can touch us, and the person touched by God in struggle will forever bear the results of having met with God in the struggle, and there will be some manifestation in their life that they have struggled with God. It's hard to struggle with God. But struggle with God we must if we are to get meaning from our experience. It is very evident that in Jacob's experience, the stranger that he wrestles with could win at any time. We know that when the struggle is done, and to let Jacob know that he has really been in power, the angel of the Lord, or God himself in angelic form, touches Jacob and simply cripples him on the spot. I don't know what he used, whether I don't suppose he used a hammerlock on the hip, but whatever he used, his strength prevailed. But Jacob refused to let go of the struggle until he knew its meaning. And this marks him as a person of spiritual greatness. If you are in a struggle, what is the spiritual meaning of that struggle? Not what's the human meaning, not what are the consequences for your family, not what are the consequences for your business, not what are the consequences for your career, but what is the meaning, what is the spiritual meaning of who you are going to emerge as from that struggle? And Jacob, therefore, wrestling in his spiritual and psychological experience, no matter how frightening and dark it is, refuses to let go until he has discovered its meaning. He, therefore, is blessed by God and given a new name. The deceiver becomes Israel. Israel meaning he who struggles with God. Or another way of stating it would even be he who struggles to prevail with God. A name reveals inner essence, and Jacob is forever changed. I pray that in your struggle of life and in my struggle of life, and I realize I am speaking prophetically to some persons here, maybe a handful, more significantly and powerfully than the rest of the audience, but you must not emerge from that struggle without having wrestled with God and finding in the midst of that struggle who you are in God. It is in our struggles that we come to terms with who we've been becoming all the years that we've been becoming. We learn where the weak lines and the fault lines in our personality are, and we learn where the strengths are, and we bring them to God. Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 and 4 says of Jacob, "In the womb he grasped his brother's heel. As a man he struggled with God. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor." What beautiful imagery. On the one hand, he struggled, the language of strength. But on the other hand, he wept, the language of weakness. He came in his struggle stronger and weaker simultaneously. He became strong by prevailing, but he wept because he needed God's favor. He emerged from that struggle broken, lame, but named and blessed. The blessing this time was untarnished. His previous blessing from Isaac was tarnished. But this time, the blessing God gave him was untarnished, not contrived, not the result of deceit. I think of Jacob when he emerged from that all-night struggle with the angel of God, realizing what it is to Return from an evening of struggle and rise to meet the morning hours. You will be weakened by that struggle. Physically weakened, but spiritually strengthened if you have met with God. And he rises to meet Esau. Fortunately, when Esau comes to him, there is reconciliation. It shows us that there is great growth in Esau's character as well. And the beautiful reconciliation they have is seen in verse 4 of Genesis chapter 33. Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. For a moment, hold your finger in that place in the Bible and turn to Luke chapter 15, to the story that Jesus told. Verse 20 of Luke 15. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Notice the similarity. Jesus uses language right out of the reconciliation of Esau and Jacob to describe the reconciliation between the long-lost son and his father. Both the long-lost son and Jacob need to come home, need to come back centered if they are to experience reality. And there is embracing, throwing arms around their necks, and kissing and weeping, and they emerge whole. Finally, Jacob comes to peace with himself. And the lifelong struggle is now banked and stoked. He is at peace. You will never be at peace unless you struggle with God and prevail. Neither will you be at peace unless you come to terms with the one who has bitterly hurt you, as did Esau. You cannot refuse to meet the person who has hurt you and whom you have hurt. And when the meeting happens, when it is in God's timing, and when he accomplishes the struggle, then the forgiveness and the restoration will be complete. I think in our society we have become conditioned to using people like disposable items. And there are moments in life where we come to partings with people, hurtful moments. But I am convinced and adept as well that if there is a parting within our life that is hurtful, and while it may be, as someone has said, that you cannot unscramble an egg, nor can you get an egg back in the yolk once it is broken, there is nevertheless something commendable about our life that seeks not to let the sun go down upon our life until we have come as best as we can to grips with the estrangement and sought healing and reconciliation. This cannot be forced. Jacob had 20 years away before the moment was even appropriate. And if he had come back earlier, his head would have probably been delicately or not so delicately separated from his neck. But in the right time, he came back, faced the struggle, and prevailed. The person who develops depth in themselves knows that their struggle is the result or results in God's overruling their sins and mistakes, knowing that God is present with us in the turning moments, and knowing that God resolves our identity as persons. We know as well that our struggles are never simply a matter of wrestling with things or people. In our wrestling with whatever we wrestle with, we must come to terms with what God seeks to do in our life. Oh Lord, we bring this simple message to a close. We realize that it is laden with meaning for a handful of people in this room. There are people tonight, Lord, whom you know in this body that struggle in the depths of their being, struggle with their own failures and what it has cost them. Some that are in crisis moments of their life, fearful of what is looming on the horizon. A very existence and calling at stake as persons. Oh God, in the midst of the uncertainty, a struggle, we, like Jacob, come to you. And teach us, O Lord, in the midst of that struggle, how to prevail. Not how to prevail over our Esau, but how to prevail with you and how to prevail over ourselves. Change the nature in us, O God, that wants to run and hide, that wants to be deceitful, that is fearful, that yields to anger, that lives in our own rutted behavior. Teach us, O God, in our crisis, to find you, to struggle with you, and to prevail. O God, we ask it in your name. Amen.